once more under the breach, dear friend.
Else close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And I'm having trouble hearing myself.
Yeah, the microphone settings are a little off. Don't mess with the headset yet, or you'll blast your ears.
Okay. And we need to do a few disclosures and disclaimers here. Let's get the first one out of the way. We advertise on KTEM, although we don't pay for this show. We do advertise on KTEM, so we do give them money for advertisements during the week. The Personal Wealth Coach is not only the name of this radio program, it's also the name of an SEC-registered investment advisor in Salado, Texas. It is neither approved or disapproved by the SEC, but is regulated by that organization. The two principals in here, Jeff and
Jake,
are the two principals at the SEC Registered Investment Advisor. So we've been working on this coincidence for some time, trying to explain it and understand it. But we're not giving investment advice during this radio program.
It's education.
Right, because investment advice is given based on your individual circumstances and a whole bunch of other stuff like that, and education is general.
As a piece of education just there, if someone gives you investment advice without asking you a lot of questions first, it's not investment advice. It's advice on investing, and it's probably not fitted to you, and that's something that a lot of people have a lot of trouble with. I don't have this problem anymore, but I used to visit the barber shop. So I'll let you figure out how that problem was solved, listeners. And quite often when they find out who I was or what I did, they would ask me these questions. I think it's probably like if you're a doctor, say you're a podiatrist, and they find out they're going to want to take their shoes off. And
oh, no.
When you're doing your hair. So, but they always want to know, what's a hot stock? What am I supposed to do? What should I buy?
I always tell them buy low, sell high.
Yeah, and that's good education.
Don't get involved in a land war in the continent of Asia.
Anybody that gives you that advice, they may tell you about a good deal, but it may be wholly unsuited for you. And so that's when we say education rather than advice on the air. And we have a caller who has braved the airways to
254-773-1400 is what he called.
A brave and diligent caller. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead. Not so brave.
This is not a brave or diligent caller.
Not a brave caller. We scared them away by calling them brave.
Can you crank my microphone up just a little bit higher?
You're in good shape. Okay. Now. So right. now you can crank up your ears.
All right. Well, let's see. Is there anything else we need to? I think we've told you all the stuff we have to tell you. We probably ought to talk about what happened in the market this week. And that is actually pretty pleasant. The market, the S&P 500 stock index rose 2.89%, which is pretty close to what the others did, too. So we just followed the S&P 500. And it closed at 2822.48, if that's important to you. Now, it's good to remember at this point. Now, 2822.48 puts it up 12.6% roughly for this year, which sounds really impressive until you realize that the high last year was 2930.75. That was a close. It actually got up to 2940 in midday. So we're still down from, if we just use closing prices, we're still down 3.7% from the high last year, even though we've come up 12.6% this year, which tells you a lot. Now, we're up. If you look at your portfolio from this time last year, you may discover that you're not much higher because it's only up 2.56%.
And some of you may find that you're not up at all. You may find that from this point last year, you're still down, and that has a lot to do with the timing of when your money went into the market.
Mm-hmm. And it's just basically the market is telling us what a lot of, we're going to talk about during the radio program, but what a lot of the data is also telling us, some things look really good and some things don't look so good. And we're kind of at the peak of the wave. We're in a bumpy plateau top, and where we go from here is pretty much anybody's guess. Meanwhile, back at the ranch, the 10-year treasury yield decline. Now, what does that mean? Interest rates are going down a little bit in general. You could think of that as good or bad.
Oh, if you're buying a house, it's good. If you're buying a bond, it's bad.
But, and that ties in very nicely, because 2.6% is where the yield dropped to, and it's down about 20% from the yield it had 5 months ago, and that's really good if you're going to buy a house. But the reason it's coming down is because people aren't buying houses.
Isn't that amazing?
So what happens is the bond market is collectively a bunch of people who are forecasting where interest rates will be in the future. And they basically have come to the conclusion that between 2 and 5 years out, things aren't going to be so good. And so we got this sag in there, so that the 5-year yield on the Treasury and the Fed short-term rate are virtually identical at this point. So we have this flat yield curve out to 5 years.
Which means it's probably a good idea to get a loan for the next 5 years, because you can get it at the same rate you could get for your one year.
if you're a big corporation.
And you have a lot of cash on hand, the banks will gladly loan you an umbrella so long as it's not raining.
Right. And we have a caller on 773-1400. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Guys, enjoy the show. There was an article in the Wall Street today about time to scrap emerging markets, and I guess the central theme is the emerging market countries in the 70s when these funds were first developed are now very, very developed, and so the term emerging market, I guess, needs to be redefined. I'm just curious if emerging markets are still part of somebody's portfolio. I'll hang up and listen.
All right. Thanks
That's
for calling.
A fantastic call. We categorize emerging markets in a different way than what was categorized in the 70s. It isn't necessarily a different way. It's different countries. If they're already emerged, if they've become developed, a great example of that would be South Korea. South Korea used to be the barrier line, and they said if somebody's per capita GDP in a country was less than South Korea, they were considered an emerging country. Well, that's not the country anymore. And just as a side note, there is no group, entity, single person, or anyone else that says this is what an emerging market is. It's opinion. It is quite subjective in many cases. There are people that look at China and say China is no longer an emerging market. I would disagree with that. I think that they still have quite a majority of people that are still operating near Stone Age technology. So they have a lot more emerging to do. South Korea is quite emerged. They are developed. So in order to look at emerging markets, there are still lots of countries that are being given the opportunity to industrialize. By given the opportunity, I mean a lot of money is being given to the employees to work at manufacturing facilities. And there's a lot of bad news about emerging markets at times when people should be looking at them with good views, and a lot of good news about emerging markets when people should be skeptical. So right now we've got a lot of bad news on emerging markets, right as our trade deficit is huge, which means that emerging markets are making a great deal of profit right now.
You know, the thing about emerging markets is taking a look at the potential in a country versus the actual makes it an emerging market. Our potential versus our actual,
pretty close to the same thing.
Pretty close to identical. And the same thing is true in Europe.
If we want to increase our potential tremendously, that would be 1 or 2%.
Yeah, and
or somebody that's in a rice paddy could increase their potential tremendously by making more than a dollar a day.
Right. And to give you some idea, we look at Russia, and by any standard that you want to measure, Russia's in pretty bad shape and has an awful lot of people who aren't producing much.
I think that is the definition of a demerging country.
It is. But the point I want to make is that the average per capita, the average per capita GDP, the per capita per person, boy, that'd be redundant all over again.
Each head on each person.
The output per person in Russia right now is double that of the output per person in China. And the output per person, for instance, in Mexico, which is definitely still an emerging market, is higher than that of the output per person in China. So Is there room for a great deal of growth still in China? Yes. Will it happen? I don't know.
That depends on governmental and market concerns, a lot of other things. It could be that they're hitting the demographic headwinds.
And,
but
you know,
they have potential.
And so to say that emerging markets aren't emerging anymore is to say that India is operating pretty much at its maximum output and will never and won't grow particularly fast.
And I've got a piece of news for you on India, since we're hitting the emerging countries. It's expected that India's population will pass China's in 2 years or a year and a half, in the middle of 2020.
Wow, that's impressive.
That's an important factor, and because that population growth isn't – it's like there's two ends of a spectrum for danger demographically. Not having enough babies. Well, look at China, look at Europe, look at Japan. We're teetering on that. We're definitely above it. Europe is not doing so well for their baby count. And then you've got the other end of the spectrum of having so many babies that you can't educate them, and that's India.
One of the things that that we look at in emerging markets, and I think this is important, is to recognize that there's a lot of opportunity there for a given fund manager, for example, to have a huge differential over some other fund manager.
Yeah,
and the reason is, you look around at industries in the United States, and they are under a microscope, and companies are under a microscope, and stock speculators and everything else are looking, and that's the way it is in Europe and the United States, where everything's pretty transparent. But as soon as you start getting into smaller emerging countries, particularly the smaller ones, or even getting into sectors within the larger emerging economies, you have to go in and be able to speak the language and talk to the people to figure out what's going on, because it's not as transparent. So you have the opportunity there for a manager to excel by selecting the countries that are likely to do much better in the future. China, to use as an example, is in a slowdown. It's still growing, but the growth rate is slowing. And there's been some really good studies that have come out and some good articles that we've got this week out of Barron's and other places that indicate that the GDP of China is at least 15% lower than reported, and maybe even more so at this point. And using the things that we can actually track, China may not be growing any faster than the United States at this point.
Yeah, and we talked about that a bit last week. And this is pure education here. Let me throw this out there, because we're talking about an area of great risk. Emerging markets are the riskiest asset class that we track. Riskiest doesn't necessarily mean bad, because they also long-term have the highest performance. But you have this mixed bag, and this is important to understand. When one person talks about emerging markets, and they have a fund that's an emerging markets fund, it's not like talking about the large cap value fund that somebody has. If you have a large cap value, it is probably very close to identical to another fund company's large cap value position, because there's really a very clear group of companies to choose from. Large cap value is a group of a couple of hundred companies that are very large, and they're generally based in the United States, and that's where people go and invest. If you've got one fund, they look very much like another. Emerging markets, not only do you have lots of companies in each country, you have lots of countries. So the risk level in emerging markets is not averaged well. It's that whole thing about, if you have 1 foot in dry ice and 1 foot in boiling water, your average temperature is fine, but you are not comfortable. Emerging markets don't average well, because it's like you take it, to coin a statistic, or to throw a statistics term in here, you take all the outliers and put them in one bucket. That does not make them regular. They are unregular.
We have another caller?
We do.
We have a caller on 773-1400. So, caller, you're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Well, another one's back.
Keep scaring them off.
I want to talk about emerging markets a little more. It's a broad area, and I would recommend that somebody is very, very deeply speculating if you go into one of the narrow emerging markets areas. The BRICS, for example, were
Brazil, Russia, India, China.
Right. And so the other thing is, it takes staying on top of the ball. Unlike, as Jake pointed out, a large cap value fund, shoot, I'm confident I could put together a large cap value fund and run it without any trouble at all.
And in fact, we have throughout our careers talked to people who just wanted to, company managers, CEOs, and so on, saying, we're going to put together a large cap value fund and make a lot of money doing it, because the fees on there are still fairly nice and you don't really have to do a lot of work.
And the same thing is true as large cap growth. You just say, okay, every company above this size whose earnings growth has been this much, and we'll put it in there. So those funds are relatively easy to run. They probably choosing one over the other. At that point, you look in there and say which one is the lowest cost, because they're probably going to perform similarly.
Right. But then emerging markets manager, one of the first questions you should ask is, how many languages do you speak?
Right. And so and actually, at this point, I've come to the conclusion the best emerging markets managers are a team of people with a deep resource of people in lots of countries around the world who do speak the local languages.
Right.
And
yeah.
So you've got a there's a tremendous opportunity in emerging markets, and over the last 40 years, that particular diversified emerging market asset class has grown the most, but it also has stayed down the longest and had the biggest dips, which, by the way, is part of what portfolio theory is all about, is the faster an asset class grows, the more often and the more severe will be its downturns.
Yeah, the faster they fall as well.
And they'll stay down a long time. So it's one of the things that there is a place in a diversified, balanced portfolio for diversified emerging markets. How much of that should be in there is another thing that takes a level of skill that I think the average person doesn't have, or the average investor doesn't have.
And this is important. We talk about this semi-regularly on the program. We are followers of a given branch of the science of economics called modern portfolio theory, or portfolio theory, which says if you look at different asset classes that are bouncy against each other, you kind of use them like shock absorbers to each other. It doesn't work all the time, but when it does work, it works fairly well. It can lower the risk of a portfolio. You have to do it right. And emerging markets is a great addition as a balance point to something that acts very differently to emerging markets. So if you only have emerging markets in your portfolio, that's a really, really bad idea, unless you're just iron hard heart and you're willing to just throw it out there and say everything, I'm betting on this, and that becomes gambling at that point.
There's a very strong correlation between the strength of the dollar and the performance of emerging market equities. So that the stronger the U.S. dollar is, and it's very strong right now, it's up substantially this year, as a matter of fact, then the worst emerging markets are going to look. And by the way, when they look the worst,
that's when they're the cheapest
to
buy.
That's when we should be buying them, when there's bad news about them.
That's when the headlines come out about how bad emerging markets
right.
are. That's what I meant at the beginning, where usually you hear bad things about emerging markets when they're should be talking good things, and you hear good things when you should be talking bad things.
It's the same thing to do with the U.S. stock market. In 2009, about this point 10 years ago, there was nothing but bad news about the United States stock market. And if you invested in anything that even vaguely looks like the broad U.S. stock market 10 years ago, today, if you look at your total return over that period, it's mind-bogglingly good.
Let's see. We were down to 600, and inter-day trading was 666. So
I remember that. And then 676 was the close.
Right, 676. What is it today? What is it you said that the S&P closed at?
The S&P closed at 2822.
So that's four times what it was 10 years ago.
Yeah. And
that is a big deal. There's
a 300% gain.
Those are risks associated with that. I mean, there's risks associated with it. You need to be in when everybody's getting out. You need to stay diversified. There's a lot of other things. Recognizing the risks is a big part of the education that we talk about here. Risks are real. You need to recognize them and deal with them before getting into anything that, those risks could affect.
Let me throw a caveat in here. We talked about the S&P 500 and it being up so much and what a wonderful investment it would have been 10 years ago. But let me tell you something else. Had you invested in it in the year 2000, when it was near its peak, and you factor in inflation and you reinvest all of your dividends and don't take a single penny out, it would have taken you 13 years to break even in the S&P 500.
Just being only in the S&P 500,
so,
that's right.
So the point is, the S&P 500 has a pretty fast historical growth rate, but being invested in the S&P 500 in this particular case involved waiting 13 years to break even. So that's why we don't recommend, even though John Bogle did say this back in the 1990s, all a reasonable investor needs in his 401k is an S&P 500 index
fund.
Yeah,
he very close to his death said that is no longer the case. He said it very clearly.
But the point is that a balanced portfolio has asset classes in it that tend to run in opposite directions. When the S&P 500 is going like gangbusters and people from outside the United States are pouring money into the United States because the S&P 500 is going like mad,
that's a good time to be looking around and saying, where else should I be right now?
The dollar will be up. Emerging markets will be down. This is the ideal time if you're a long-term investor. And I want to emphasize, you sometimes have to wait years for this.
And you don't double down on it. Right. You take it as part of the portfolio.
You include. That's why we include emerging markets, diversified emerging markets in a portfolio, is because it tends to run in the opposite direction of the S&P 500. Now, for short periods, like 2007 through 2009, everything goes down together, and there's no dodging that.
Yeah, there's a really, really geeky economics statement. In a panic, all correlations go to one. If you expect to know what that means, it means everything goes down. There's no real safe haven in a panic. That's what the definition of a panic is. Everybody wants to sell. Why? Well, because I'm scared.
And in those
not because they like or dislike what they're selling.
And panics happen. And when panics happen, the only safe place is cash and short-term bonds, high-grade short-term bonds. And so it's always good to keep an element of cash reserve, short-term bonds. And we like to keep it for a minimum of 18 months, and 18 months of whatever you would need over the next 18 months. Why? Well, because that's about how long panics last before they recover if you've got a balanced portfolio. So portfolio theory, which is what we try to practice, is still a theory, but then so is relativity.
Well, yeah, but it's not quite as provable as relativity, because portfolio theory is based on human behavior. Well, relativity is based on some pretty fundamental forces like gravity and gravity waves and light speeds.
Mm-hmm. But it's still, parts of it are still goofy in physics, and a lot of stuff is still goofy in portfolio theory, but it's just the best thing we have. And if you don't know what portfolio theory is, very frankly, managing your own portfolio is a crapshoot.
Yes.
So, anyway, telephone number in here. This is the Personal Wealth Coach, and the telephone number remains 254-773-1400. I have to concentrate to say that.
Do you want to play our commercials? It's right at the halfway
mark. Well, I want you to play the commercials.
All right, let's do it. We'll play some commercials. We'll be back on the other side. If you'd like to join the conversation, the phone number in here is 254-773-1400, and we'll be back.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, we're back with more of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. I wonder if there's any boys and girls who actually listen to this program.
Well, there's grown-up boys and girls. My daughter, who's 4, occasionally asks her mother to turn on the radio program.
Turn the radio
on.
She'll
say, I want to hear Dad. I want to hear Daddy. She calls me Daddo. I want to hear Daddo. So she'll turn on the radio program, and in about 20 seconds, okay, turn it off.
I have one son who routinely listens to this program.
It's not me, because
yeah.
I'm not listening.
Yeah, you are.
What are you talking about? I didn't even hear what you said.
Well, let's get back to the economy and such things. Telephone number in here remains 254-773-1400. And if today is March 16th, where you are, and in the waning days of winter. You know, realize we only have half a week of winter left.
Yes, so use it wisely.
The 20th of March is when spring officially arrives this year. 21st is the first full day of spring, so you've just got a few days of winter left to shiver, and then it's going to warm up suddenly.
Don't waste those winter days. There's only a few of them left, and you should use them for something.
And the 20th is the equinox.
Not really sure.
That means we have equal quantities of noxious stuff.
Yeah, the noct and is the day, or it's the night in this particular equinox. Means day and night are equal, same length.
Yeah.
Or it could be noxious.
Yeah, it could be. Whatever.
I kind of like your definition better.
Anyway, we have some interesting things going on in the economy, and the problem is they're contradictory.
Yes. And that we're both seeing the same thing in the data right now.
U.S. factory output fell 4% in February after falling, 0.4% in February, 4%, that'd be amazing, 0.4% in February after falling 0.4%, 0.5% in January. And we're seeing new housing starts decline. We see automobile sales declining. We see a growing consistency in the hard data, meaning the hardware being sold. We see the durable goods purchases sliding downhill. They're still in pretty good shape, but they're decreasing in their growth rate. So what we're seeing is, over on one side of the economy, the traditional industrial side of the economy, we're seeing the growth rate either slowing down or in some cases going backwards. Now production in the same country, in those same companies, we said output, their production was up a whopping 0.1%, which is not much, but their output is down, and that's esoteric, but it means that they're kind of at a balance point. And we don't know which way they're going to go from here, and frankly, neither do they. When you ask the people which the surveys do from the Bureau of Economic Analysis, what do you think's going on out there? And what they're saying is tariffs have got them scared, and they've got their customers scared, and they're basically pulling back in. They can't find enough people to operate more machinery, so they're not investing in more machinery. And if they could operate more machinery and could find the people, they still couldn't get the stuff they made delivered in a reasonable time, nor could they get raw materials in a reasonable time because the transportation system is overloaded. So we've hit something that used to be pretty esoteric and maybe still is to you, called capacity utilization. We've hit the limits in our society, and it takes years to develop a larger infrastructure. For example, when we get truck trains that are truck trains, that means a series of, say, five trucks heading across the country driven by an AI,
right?
We'll have a bigger infrastructure. But until that happens, the railroads are pretty much full up. The highways are pretty much full up. And if you want to just drive through Temple this morning, you can tell the highways are not operating. Whatever the speed limit is, you ain't going it in most cases. And I drove down to the airport to pick somebody up last night and came back. And in significant areas on a Friday, late Friday evening, when the traffic normally wasn't quite so heavy, we weren't going to speed limit anymore. And what that means is we've hit some infrastructure limits. Now, there's some good news, too. You want to bring the good news, or you want me to?
There's a piece of infrastructure good news. It's not public infrastructure. This is oil, but it fits very well. There's something called a duck well. I love that. It's a DUC.
Are they drill for ducks?
It's drilled but uncompleted.
Hmm.
So a duck well. We are at we talk about this sometimes. The rig count. The rig counts peaked out in 2015 in the United States, right around 2,000 rigs. What's a rig? Well, those are the old derrick-looking things, or the little bird-looking thing that bounces its head up and down as it's pumping stuff out of the oil well. There are other kinds of rigs as well. The fracking rig looks more like a walled-off enterprise with kind of almost looks like a tank on top of it, because you can't really tell what's going on under the ground, unlike the pressure well where you've got the head moving up and down. Looks like an old water pump. The drilled but uncompleted wells are at a record place right now. In 2015, we were at about 2,000 rigs, and now we're at 1,086. Well, that must mean we're producing less oil, people will say. No, because we're producing a lot more oil from each rig. That's why we've been able to go to half the rigs and produce far more than twice as much oil. And we have this huge backlog where all we're waiting for is the price of oil to come up a bit.
Mm-hmm. And it is.
And then you turn on the pump at the drilled but uncompleted well. And then we immediately are able, without additional investment or very small additional investment, to produce oil and sell it on the open market. So right now, with the price of oil going up, this is one of the best things that the oil and gas sector could see. They're sitting on a lot of cash. They've consolidated from all of the wildcatters that went out of business. They've been purchased up by the bigger companies, and now it's being managed like a business again.
Well, speaking of the markets, the oil, the price of oil was up 4.2% for the week. And it's up over 25% year to date. Now, why? Not because of increased demand around the world, although there is some of that. The demand is higher than was anticipated. But because OPEC has voluntarily said we're going to restrict output to raise prices because it's not really profitable to pump oil at this. As profitable as we'd like to pump oil at this rate. The problem with OPEC trying to raise prices up to set, they basically would love to see it at $70 per barrel. The problem with that is that Jake just pointed out is we have the ability in the United States to come online with a lot more production. Now, what's our restrictions here? Again, it's infrastructure. The infrastructure restriction is we don't have enough pipelines, trucks, and trains to carry the oil to the refineries or to the ports or wherever it needs to get to offset what's coming into the United States. We're still importing a lot of oil in the United States, even though we produce more oil than we need, simply because we can't get the oil from the oil fields to the refineries. It's a very complex thing that takes years to resolve, but I think we're going to. There was a big meeting down, what was it, San Antonio?
Yeah.
This week, where the industry heads all got together and the Secretary of Energy showed up and the Secretary of State showed up. It's a big deal where they basically say we need to lay more pipelines and have more infrastructure. When we talk about investing in infrastructure, we have a lot of oil in the ground in the United States that we can't get to market. And we can get to the oil, but we got to figure out how to get it to the markets. And that's one of the things that's holding things back.
Yeah.
Now, there's – can I change the subject?
Yeah. I think we hit good news and bad news on infrastructure there.
Well, I want to point out something else.
This is the conflicting data that we're seeing kind of across the board.
The United States economy is about 70% consumer, which is good. I know that a lot of people think we should be industrialized, where a majority of our economy is making stuff. But the point is that if you make a lot more stuff than your consumers consume, you're dependent upon an export market, and of course, the president and a lot of people said we should be exporting more and importing less. The problem with exporting and having your economy, like the German economy and the Chinese economy, largely dependent upon exports, is you're dependent upon your customer who's outside of your control, outside of the country.
Yeah, if China has a downturn or Germany has a downturn, it's probably because the U.S. had a downturn.
Mm-hmm. Well, we stopped buying so much of their stuff.
Right. Well, if they have a downturn and we're buying stuff from them, it's just cheaper now.
Mm-hmm. And so we have an advantage, and the spending by consumers in the United States is up. There's a plus to that and there's a minus to that. Retail sales in January were 2.3% above those of a year ago. Now, if you notice that the fourth quarter GDP on an annualized basis rose 2.6%. Spending was up 2.3%. That is not a coincidence that those two come together. Now, as a matter of fact, retail sales, pulling out automobiles and gasoline, which are very, very volatile. Gasoline is particularly volatile, particularly if you light it on fire.
I've noticed that.
But
we're not recommending that as any part of your portfolio to light gasoline on fire in it. No,
we actually had sales fall in December, which was really odd. But they were up 3.7% in January, and this is really a good recovery.
It's not exceedingly odd to think how little the sales dropped, because we had a lot of people out of work that aren't usually out of work at that point. We had a government shutdown going on in December, and so when you see spending drop and then immediately recover in January, that December was odd. There's no other way of looking at it.
And we have a caller on 773-1400?
Yes. Caller, you're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Oh, well, hello. My name is Tyler, and I'm from Temple. I just wanted to ask you guys a couple questions about debt in the USA and kind of get your take on what its potential economic impact could be. And just a few bullet points, because I don't want to take up too much time, but I know corporate debt is at an all-time high and has climbed 40% since its highs in 2008. Also, U.S. household debt is at record highs. Also, the CLO market, which I'm sure you guys know what that is, the collateralized loan market.
Mm-hmm.
They kind of are like CDOs, but they allow corporations to leverage loans in like corporate mergers and stuff like that. Anyways, that market has grown to over $1 trillion. Also, I know we're experiencing pretty good GDP growth, and the economy's kind of humming along, but at the same time, the federal government is running almost a $1 trillion deficit, which kind of seems weird considering we are in, you know, a 10-year economic boom cycle. Shouldn't the government be running surpluses? So I'm worried about the Fed's balance sheet and its ability to react to the next inevitable recession. And so I kind of wanted to get your guys' take on how all that debt, how we're exposed to all this debt, despite the fact the economy is booming, and could that point to some weakness in the underlying fundamentals of the economy? So, yeah.
Whoa. Good.
You obviously questions. Have been reading entirely too much.
Yes. You sound like you've been sitting into our conversations lately at the office. The debt levels are dangerous. Debt is kind of give some broad overview of the question first. Debt in general is not bad. Loan shark debt, bad. High credit card debt, bad. Mortgage debt, if you're living in the house and you can afford to pay for it, good. A lot of the corporate loans are good loans. They used those loans. They have the ability to pay the loans back because of the profit that they gained by investing the money that they got the loans to invest. When we look at overall debt, there's some important factors to run in there. Number one, let me kind of separate out the government side of what you were just saying from the corporate and consumer debt. Government debt is up, and this is something that the heroes of the Democrats, John Maynard Keynes, and the heroes of the Republicans, Milton Friedman, agreed on. Don't get a lot of debt when you're in a booming economy. Kind of across the board, there are quite a lot of things that they agreed on that the Republicans and the Democrats cannot agree with. Keynes did not advocate for stimulus spending at the top of an economy. And the Democrats quite often in the past have said, that's a good idea. We'll just borrow a lot of money and spend it, and we'll keep the economy running very well. We'll
listen to this program.
Well, there's grown-up boys and girls. My daughter, who's 4, occasionally asks her mother to turn on the radio program.
Turn the radio
She'll
on.
She'll say, I want to hear Dad. I want to hear Daddy. She calls me Daddo. I want to hear Daddo. So she'll turn on the radio program, and in about 20 seconds. Okay, turn it off.
I have one son who routinely listens to this program.
It's not me, because I'm not listening.
Yeah, you are.
What are you talking about? I didn't even hear what you said.
Well, let's getting back to the economy and such things. Telephone number in here remains 254-773-1400. And if today is March 16th, where you are, and in the waning days of winter, you know, realize we only have half a week of winter left.
Yes, so use it wisely.
The 20th of March is when spring officially arrives this year. 21st is the first full day of spring, so you've just got a few days of winter left to shiver, and then it's going to warm up suddenly.
Don't waste those winter days. There's only a few of them left, and you should use them for something.
And the 20th is the equinox.
Not really sure.
That means we have equal quantities of noxious stuff.
Yeah, the noct and is the day, or it's the night in this particular. Equinox means day and night are equal, same length.
Yeah.
Or it could be noxious.
Yeah,
it could be. Whatever. I kind of like your definition better.
Anyway, we have some interesting things going on in the economy, and the problem is they're contradictory.
Yes. And that we're both seeing the same thing in the data right now.
U.S. factory output fell 4% in February after falling. 0.4% in February. 4%, that'd be amazing. 0.4% in February after falling 0.4%, 0.5% in January. And we're seeing new housing starts decline. We see automobile sales declining. We see a growing consistency in the hard data, meaning the hardware being sold. We see the durable goods purchases sliding downhill. They're still in pretty good shape, but they're decreasing in their growth rate. So what we're seeing is over on one side of the economy, the traditional industrial side of the economy, we're seeing the growth rate either slowing down or in some cases going backwards. Now, production in the same country, in those same companies, we said output, their production was up a whopping 0.1%, which is not much. But their output is down, and that's esoteric, but it means that they're kind of at a balance point. And we don't know which way they're going to go from here, and frankly, neither do they. When you ask the people who, which the surveys do from the Bureau of Economic Analysis, what do you think's going on out there? And what they're saying is tariffs have got them scared, and they've got their customers scared, and they're basically pulling back in. They can't find enough people to operate more machinery, so they're not investing in more machinery. And if they could operate more machinery and could find the people, they still couldn't get the stuff they made delivered in a reasonable time, nor could they get raw materials in a reasonable time because the transportation system is overloaded. So we've hit something that used to be pretty esoteric and maybe still is to you, called capacity utilization. We've hit the limits in our society. And it takes years to develop a larger infrastructure. For example, when we get truck trains that are truck trains, that means a series of, say, five trucks heading across the country driven by an AI,
right,
we'll have a bigger infrastructure. But until that happens, the railroads are pretty much full up. The highways are pretty much full up. And if you want to just drive through Temple this morning, you can tell the highways are not operating. Whatever the speed limit is, you ain't going it in most cases. And I drove down to the airport to pick somebody up last night and came back. And in significant areas on a Friday, late Friday evening, when the traffic normally wasn't quite so heavy, we weren't going to speed limit anymore. And what that means is we've hit some infrastructure limits. Now, there's some good news, too. You want to bring the good news or you want me to?
There's a piece of infrastructure good news. It's not public infrastructure. This is oil, but it fits very well. There's something called a duck well. I love that. It's a DUC.
Are they drill for ducks?
It's drilled but uncompleted.
Hmm.
So a duck well. We are at we talk about this sometimes. The rig count. The rig counts peaked out in 2015 in the United States, right around 2,000 rigs. What's a rig? Well, those are the old derrick-looking things, or the little bird-looking thing that bounces its head up and down as it's pumping stuff out of the oil well. There are other kinds of rigs as well. The fracking rig looks more like a walled-off enterprise with kind of a almost looks like a tank on top of it, because you can't really tell what's going on under the ground, unlike the pressure well where you've got the head moving up and down. Looks like an old water pump. The drilled but uncompleted wells are at a record place right now. In 2015, we were at about 2,000 rigs, and now we're at 1,086. Well, that must mean we're producing less oil, people will say. No, because we're producing a lot more oil from each rig. That's why we've been able to go to half the rigs and produce far more than twice as much oil. And we have this huge backlog where all we're waiting for is the price of oil to come up a bit.
Mm-hmm. And it is.
And then you turn on the pump at the drilled but uncompleted well. And then we immediately are able, without additional investment or very small additional investment, to produce oil and sell it on the open market. So right now, with the price of oil going up, this is one of the best things that the oil and gas sector could see. They're sitting on a lot of cash. They've consolidated from all of the wildcatters that went out of business. They've been purchased up by the bigger companies, and now it's being managed like a business again.
Well, speaking of the markets, the price of oil was up 4.2% for the week. And it's up over 25% year to date. Now, why? Not because of increased demand around the world, although there is some of that. The demand is higher than was anticipated. But because OPEC has voluntarily said we're going to restrict output to raise prices, because it's not really profitable to pump oil at this. It's profitable as we'd like to pump oil at this rate. The problem with OPEC trying to raise prices up to set they basically would love to see it at $70 per barrel. The problem with that is that Jake just pointed out is we have the ability in the United States to come online with a lot more production. Now, what's our restrictions here? Again, it's infrastructure. The infrastructure restriction is we don't have enough pipelines, trucks, and trains to carry the oil to the refineries or to the ports or wherever it needs to get to offset what's coming into the United States. We're still importing a lot of oil in the United States, even though we produce more oil than we need, simply because we can't get the oil from the oil fields to the refineries. It's a very complex thing that takes years to resolve, but I think we're going to. There was a big meeting down, San Antonio?
Yeah.
This week, where the industry heads all got together and the Secretary of Energy showed up and the Secretary of State showed up. It's a big deal where they basically say we need to lay more pipelines and have more infrastructure. When we talk about investing in infrastructure, we have a lot of oil in the ground in the United States that we can't get to market. And we can get to the oil, but we got to figure out how to get it to the markets. And that's one of the things that's holding things back.
Yeah.
Now there's – can I change the subject?
Yeah. I think we hit good news and bad news on infrastructure there.
Well, I want to point out something else.
This is the conflicting data that we're seeing kind of across the board.
The United States economy is about 70% consumer, which is good. I know that a lot of people think we should be industrialized, where a majority of our economy is making stuff. But the point is that if you make a lot more stuff than your consumers consume, you're dependent upon an export market, and of course, the president and a lot of people said we should be exporting more and importing less. The problem with exporting and having your economy, like the German economy and the Chinese economy, largely dependent upon exports, is you're dependent upon your customer who's outside of your control, outside of the country.
Yeah, if China has a downturn or Germany has a downturn, it's probably because the U.S. had a downturn.
Mm-hmm. Well, we stopped buying so much of their stuff.
Right. Well, if they have a downturn and we're buying stuff from them, it's just cheaper now.
Mm-hmm. And so we have an advantage, and the spending by consumers in the United States is up. There's a plus to that and there's a minus to that. Retail sales in January were 2.3% above those of a year ago. Now, if you notice that the fourth quarter GDP on an annualized basis rose 2.6%. Spending was up 2.3%. That is not a coincidence that those two come together. Now, as a matter of fact, sales, retail sales, pulling out automobiles and gasoline, which are very, very volatile. Gasoline is particularly volatile, particularly if you light it on fire.
I've noticed that.
But
we're not recommending that as any part of your portfolio, to light gasoline on fire in it. No,
we actually had sales fall in December, which was really odd. But they were up 3.7% in January. And this is really good recovery.
It's not exceedingly odd to think how little the sales dropped, because we had a lot of people out of work that aren't usually out of work at that point. We had a government shutdown going on in December. And so when you see spending drop and then immediately recover in January, that December was odd. There's no other way of looking at it.
And we have a caller on 773-1400.
Yes, caller, you're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Oh, well, hello. My name is Tyler, and I'm from Temple. I just wanted to ask you guys a couple questions about debt in the USA and kind of get your take on what its potential economic impact could be. And just a few bullet points, because I don't want to take up too much time, but I know corporate debt is at an all-time high and has climbed 40% since its highs in 2008. Also, U.S. household debt is at record highs. Also, the CLO market, which I'm sure you guys know what that is, the collateralized loan market.
Mm-hmm.
They kind of are like CDOs, but they allow corporations to leverage loans in like corporate mergers and stuff like that. Anyways, that market has grown to over $1 trillion. Also, I know we're experiencing pretty good GDP growth, and the economy's kind of humming along. But at the same time, the federal government is running almost a $1 trillion deficit, which kind of seems weird considering we are in, you know, a 10-year economic boom cycle. Shouldn't the government be running surpluses? So I'm worried about the Fed's balance sheet and its ability to react to the next inevitable recession. And so I kind of wanted to get your guys' take on how all that debt, how we're exposed to all this debt, despite the fact the economy is booming, and could that point to some weakness in the underlying fundamentals of the economy? So, yeah.
Whoa. Good.
You obviously questions. Have been reading entirely too much.
Yes. You sound like you've been sitting into our conversations lately at the office. The debt levels are dangerous. Debt is kind of give some broad overview of the question first. Debt in general is not bad. Loan shark debt, bad. High credit card debt, bad. Mortgage debt, if you're living in the house and you can afford to pay for it, good. A lot of the corporate loans are good loans. They used those loans. They have the ability to pay the loans back because of the profit that they gained by investing the money that they got the loans to invest. When we look at overall debt, there's some important factors to run in there. Number one, let me kind of separate out the government side of what you were just saying from the corporate and consumer debt. Government debt is up, and this is something that the heroes of the Democrats, John Maynard Keynes, and the heroes of the Republicans, Milton Friedman, agreed on. Don't get a lot of debt when you're in a booming economy. Kind of across the board, there are quite a lot of things that they agreed on that the Republicans and the Democrats cannot agree with. Keynes did not advocate for stimulus spending at the top of an economy. And the Democrats quite often in the past have said, that's a good idea. We'll just borrow a lot of money and spend it, and we'll keep the economy running very well.